Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the future of UN peacekeeping missions in Africa. I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Andrew Yochi. Andrew is a senior researcher at the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Buckingham, amongst other roles that is involved in. Andrew, I'm very delighted to have you join me today. I know we've had some back and forth in terms of the timing and this, but I'm glad we finally have you on board there. Thank you, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let me start off. There's this perception, I don't know if you agree with it, the foreign military intervention under the UN missions in Africa has failed or is failing. And if you agree with that perception, why? What are the factors that have contributed to that? But if you don't, then why?
I mean, I think it's a controversial point. So let me start by saying, I think in all cases, there are challenges, and those challenges persist partly because of the nature of those conflicts. One, the evolution and nature in terms of the dynamics, but also the actors. But also, I would say the situation has become very much more politicized than it was in the 90s, or even for that sake, when UN peacekeeping operations were first thought of or designed. And so in any of the research that I've done, what we try to do is maintain a balance between fair criticism, but also the nature of what UN is trying to respond to. And so to answer your question, yes, to some degree, you can argue some missions haven't been as effective as would have hoped. But I think over time, what we have seen is that many of those missions have have tried to reach their ultimate abilities by trying to be more effective over time. And so with any mission, there's always going to be challenges and whatnot that start. But if you add that or add in addition to that challenge, then you have things like intervening facts, like, for example, missing disinformation or, for example, an election. All of these things have a ramification on how the UN positions itself, but also more widely how the peacekeeping operation responds. And so to answer your question, as I'm trying to do, as you can tell, it's not an easy answer. And in essence, it is a mixed result, I would suggest. On one hand, where you can see that in the early 90s, particularly, there were some challenges. In the early 2000s, particularly when people like Kofi Annan were at the helm, there were UN peacekeeping missions that were successful. But largely speaking, where we are now, they have large amounts of challenges. One around, again, as I said, logistics, support, all of that other aspect, the mandates also being more extensive than they were in the 90s. So all of these are additional factors that I think it would be unfair to just sort of say, okay, actually, that's it. And I think what we are observing, which is clear, is more of a decline in the use of UN peacekeeping operations.
Interesting. I had, for one of the episodes, we had Shedrick Conan come, and he also did made a distinction between the 90s, UN Peace Commission, the 90s, and you know, the late to the recent. And one interesting thing he said was, whereas in the 90s there was the willingness to use more political solutions, you know, diplomatic solutions, but whereas now we've seen less of that, and there's this need for stabilization, whereas there's less use of diplomatic channels or diplomacy, and then more kind of like forces. But I don't know if you can expand on that.
Yeah, so I mean, I concur with those findings, and that's similar to what I've done in my own research. So one thing that we are seeing is that we are seeing political missions, or as it were, more diplomatic efforts were there in the 90s. Long term, oftentimes long types of mediation efforts, where you'd maybe have UN, AU actors, oftentimes trying to deal with more peace building, or from a peace building mediation perspective. And so you had more Western involvement, as it were, but more long-term engagement. Oftentimes now in the African continent case, what you then tend to happen is you have some mediation, some talks in the background, but to sustain that and sustain the cost of that, oftentimes is a challenge for institutions like the AU and regional bodies, because it costs money to send an envoy back and forth. If you just take the situation of Mali, when you had the former president, Goodluck Jonathan, going back and forth on a jet to engage, these things are costly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's all of these costs and what come with it and the negotiations back and forth that I think in the 90s, we were more willing to invest in that side, i.e. the prevention side of things. And this speaks widely to conversations around the APSA, and this is African Peace and Security Architecture, which is really designed to prevent conflict, versus now actually the security options being, as it were, the only alternatives that people try to or tend to rely on, largely because of the framing around the war on terror, terrorism and insurgencies, that governments tend to focus more on this as opposed to let's engage with these people in conversation. So if you were to look back at the 80s and 90s, you would see more negotiations that took place, partly, particularly in the 90s after South Africa sort of transitioned, you see the South African diplomatic corps coming out, or Ghana doing more diplomacy, Nigeria doing more of this. That has all changed now. Yeah? And oftentimes what you see is the first response being, okay, we try some diplomatic stuff, it hasn't worked, security. And so what we have been arguing for in our research is a more broader approach, which again, learns some of the lessons, but is more adaptive to the context and to the situation. Why? One, as I said, the evolution of conflicts is constantly changing and evolving. Two, the context in which you're operating will constantly change. Dynamics are, and borders are not as defined as they once were in the 90s. People are moving in and out, migrations, all of these other things, the impact of climate change, all of this means that you have to take an adaptive approach to the situation. Yeah. And what that means is that the route to A to B might not be as simple as A to B. It might be A1, A2, A3 before you then get to B. And so that understanding is crucial and important to how we respond to conflict. And so if you take that sort of situation, that scenario that we're in the African continent, then you look at the way in which UN peacekeeping was designed or has evolved to where it is now, that is largely supposed to do with two actors. One actor on one side might be the state, who is an actor that, you know, comes to some sort of agreement. On the other actor, you have the, what's it called, the insurgents, or the what's it called, the opposition groups, who has a political motive. They agree, and then UN peacekeeping deployed to keep the peace. We're no longer having those situations. What we have now is situations where you have to deploy, where the other side doesn't want to negotiate. And so that requires a level of force, but that also requires a more adaptive and more whole approach to dealing and tackling that issue. Largely because you're dealing with people and whatnot.
Very interesting. It does say, but even if you look at it, like from the 90s to now, there's always been interest. So maybe it's a lot more dynamic now, like you've pointed out, there's climate change, there's, you know, some form of migration patterns that kind of like complicate things. But then there's cost as well. But again, those interests have always been there. You know, we could see, you pointed the war on terror, and then we're seeing in these places, but I wanted to talk about the interest of not just, because we have several intervening states, isn't it, in the UN missions. You have several states contributing to these missions. And each of these states, we have their interests. Maybe America would have like maybe terror security, whether the EU would be like migration or to stem all of that. But we've been seeing as well where let's go to DRC for instance. I've read somewhere where MONUSCO seems to be the longest UN peacekeeping mission, but you know it's one that is being accused of so many things, including the mission itself or having a vested interest in some of the regional dynamics in that region.
I mean, I couldn't speak to the interest of the UN in terms of the regional dynamics. What I would say with that situation is, I think what is evident from both sides, as in the government side, and I don't speak for the government, I don't speak for the UN in this case, but one thing that I observe is that oftentimes with the government, whether it's Joseph Kabila or Tshisekedi that you have now, everybody has used the anti sort of UN when it suits them. Yeah, so that is a problem. Mm. And I think UN missions have always had to deal with that, particularly in the case of DRC, early 2000s, 2010s elections to where we are now. There's always a need to blame somebody else or point the other direction. Why? Oftentimes because it's a lack of leadership. Oftentimes because ultimately, if the government wants to deal with that situation, they would deal with the situation. And I think one thing, and that's why I sort of alluded to in my question, I think we are also at the point where in the continent where we now have to say, actually, these interventions, okay, they are here designed short term to support, but we now need to be looking internally to say, actually, we need to rethink how we mediate, how we deal with these situations, how we bring parties together, but ultimately how we govern and the leadership that governs our people. And I think really it's down to voters, but also the wider continent, young people, to actually say, okay, are these the right people that we want in power? And if they're not the right people, who are those people that we need to look for as advocates or voices that can bring about that change? Because in most cases that you see, most of these armed groups don't emerge for no reason. They emerge from challenges and issues. Whether it's be the fact that you have a difference between the center and the peripheries, or between economic development in those areas, or no jobs, no hope, whatever, or the state repression, whatever have you, you can name it. And if you look back in history, you see that. And so I think, like I said, there is a wider conversation here to say, actually, if we keep on going and relying on interventions, and again, I'm not saying interventions are wrong, I'm saying more broadly speaking, we also need the African continent now to get grip and grapple with some of this. And I think we are seeing that from the security side. We're seeing more African regional organizations coming together and deploying to deal with this situation. But again, the focus has been on security only and not more broader aspects. Like, for example, politically engaging long-term, politically engaging in mediation efforts, engaging in humanitarian relief, all of these things that are important for those people who take up arms. So I think a more broader aspect is important. And so to your point on DRC, I think there is where the balance needs to be struck. It's all good blaming the UN, say they haven't done that. Yeah, even if they haven't and they put out tomorrow, the reality is the DRC would have to deal with its own security issues. Does it have the capacity? I don't think so. Two, even if it does have the capacity, is it willing to agree and negotiate with all of those 130, I think the last estimate was 130 odd groups, not terrorist groups, but groups in that region, and that's just in the Kivu areas. Does it have the capacity to deal with it? And that's another. Is it really willing to develop the area? And those are questions I think we need to ask more broadly, as opposed to saying that the UN peacekeeping is the easiest option to sort of slate. And then again, I'm not diverting or speaking for the UN. I'm saying, well, a more broader aspect is important, because even if these UN missions are not deployed, you would still have that security issue.
I agree with you, to be honest. I agree with you on the complexity of the whole situation. But before I come to the African layer, the political, let me talk about the populace, because you mentioned the youth, the population. So I had one of the, I can't remember now, I think it was an article that I reviewed. And I was surprised to see where the author has, taken a survey and people, it was not in Nigeria, and where they're saying, oh, we're Boko Haram, we need the UN. And a lot of time we forget that the UN missions are often one, they need to be invited either by the government or whatever to come to those places. And people say at this point, we need the UN to come and intervene. But now, if I look at what's going on in the Sahel, I look at the population, I look at the science, the population often express their frustration or whatever through maybe, you know, such kind of like protest. But how they are then channeled or how they become effective, because then again, you see some of these elites take advantage, like in the side, you see the military, or you see the Russian Wagner, you see all of that. And then you see the Arab Spring as well, where it's led to. So how does the population, I think I have an idea in my head, but I want to get your perspective. How can the population itself be effective, the people? Knowing that, how can they be effective in choosing the right leader, in demanding what is right, and, you know, effecting that kind of change? How can they do it?
Well, I think one is dialogue. That's the main thing for me. That's a really crucial point. Who are we dialoguing with in terms of the leadership? Are we conveying and putting forward our points? And in what manner? And what are our expectations of those through that dialogue? Second thing is the leadership. Who are those in charge? Who are they part of? Where did they go to school? All of these background questions are crucially important. Because if they come from a nepotist system or are part of the elites, that's the question that I would be asking. Is that person the right person that's going to look after my interests? Now, everyone will have an interest, but it's important that you're able to, again, not just nudge, but also allow those people to lead in the direction that works for you as a young person. The third point would really be, what do they stand for? What are their morals? How do they represent the people that, or the area that they come from, as an MP, as a local constituent? How do they resonate and talk to you and your issues? And I'm not just talking about from a Western perspective, and then you talk about even in an African context, really digging deep and saying, okay, but what do you stand for? What is your, you know, on the first 100 days, what are you going to deliver? How are you going to deliver? If there's issues on around economic reconstruction, actually ask them, are you the right person for the job? Who are you going to put in those various ministries if you do come to power? So I think we need to be more forward in terms of those questions and ask it. But also, I think it's also important, I think, looking at Senegal as an example, particularly because of what they've just come up through, it's also important to re-empower some of the young people to also lead. I think that's important. Yeah. You know, there are many young people who are, I would say, more than capable of leading the way forward in terms of, you know, out the box thinking, innovation, creativity, about how you bring in fintech and all these other aspects to the African continent. And I think there's so much there that can be done. I think the other aspect really is about, once these people are in power, what are the institutions and mechanisms that we want to empower to ensure that they're held accountable? And what I mean by empower is, some of the African institutions that we have are either weak or are growing. And so really what it's then about is, how do we build the capacity of these institutions to hold these leaders accountable, so that when they fall in line or offline, or should I say out of line, for a better word, then we can hold them accountable for the institutions. And that, for me, that is the most important thing. What we can't have is a situation where we continue to combat corruption and all these other issues. We know that it exists in everywhere around the world. But now, I think in the African context, we need to look beyond that now and say, okay, what institutions do we want that can hold these people accountable? Beyond that, then, it's then about the focus. Then the focus then shifts away from just purely the leader to the institutions that serve my needs, your needs, everybody else's needs, as opposed to the institution that serves the leader's needs. And I think we've spent the last 20, 30 years building up leaders in Africa, which has been good in some respects, but hasn't been the leadership that we need to move the continent forward. One that unites Africa, two that really, you know, ignites this new thinking around Pan-Africanism and what that means for us as a new generation, but also three, liberates the African continent from the economic challenges and problems it has. Why is it that in this day and age, when everyone is moving to green technologies and we have all of them raw materials, that we are not benefiting from that? One aspect is the climate change aspect. Okay, fine, we can ask for, you know, reparations for all of that stuff, but why are we not really tapping into that technology ourselves? And I think that is the question for me that I would be asking and saying, okay, really, how do we empower our institutions to be able to deliver that sort of prosperity for Africa?
No, I think I agree with you as well. And I think that mirrors what I'm doing currently in my research, looking at relationship between, so what you call an institution, I'm looking at our system, in what the system that brings this in leaders needs to be questioned. You know, what system allows the election of maybe it's a system that supports corruption, a system that supports that kind of stuff. I think I agree with you on that, but I'm looking at it within the relationship between our adoption of maybe liberal democracy, or if we have to start looking at, you know, what sort of system works for the continent. But let me go to the African led. You know, often I'm glad you say sometimes we spotlight the UN missions, but you've also talked about the African led or African support peacekeeping mission. We saw one in Somalia now. I think there was an African led one in Somalia. How is that an alternative to the UN peacekeeping mission? Is that in a supportive way, and how effective has it been?
I wouldn't say it's an alternative. I would say it's an evolution to the responses and those challenges that existed, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, in the African Union's terms, or AU's terms, and I'll use the acronym AU going forward, mm-hmm. The AU sees a mission like Somalia as an African-led peace support operation. And peace support operation, as the definition is quite different, and the coding mm-hmm. and others have written quite extensively about that. Again, one UN peacekeeping, holding or keeping peace where there is peace to be kept. We have a peace mm-hmm. agreement, they hold mm-hmm. and, you know, they agree. Where the African peace support operations are supporting peace, oftentimes focus on the state, i.e. mm. a country's in trouble, we need to stabilize the country, we deploy a peace support operation to create environment or room for stability. Mm. So those concepts are different. One, in the UN terms, would be classified as enforcement. In the AU's mm. terms, it's peace and support operations. And so what we have seen is, in situations where a state is in crisis, or there are challenges in a particular region, the African Union and others, and when I mean others, I'm talking about the regional economic communities, so in this case, ECOWAS, SADC, IGAD, North East, South Central, have deployed their what has largely been classified as peace support operations, or African-led peace support operations, to deal with these situations. Oftentimes, using one of the pillars of the APSA, in this case, the African Standby Force, and institutional mechanisms to deploy those forces. And oftentimes, again, focus on hard security or medium time or medium type security to sort of counterterrorism approaches. And these deployments are oftentimes, again, designed to support the state, put back onto a path of stability. So if you look at the East African force that was deployed recently to the Eastern DRC, that was made up of the regional forces from that area, or two contributing countries, who deployed to Eastern DRC to, as it were, deal with the security issues that were emerging from Eastern DRC. The recent deployment of South African forces from SADC, which is the southern South African regional bloc under REX, to Mozambique, is an example of another REC being deployed. And then you have the other type, which again are where you have one or two countries that cross over regional mechanisms, and this says economic community mechanisms, and they form coalitions. So, for example, the one that is oftentimes used is the multinational joint task force in West Africa, but that also with HR based, and that also covers Chad, obviously. The G5 Sahel is another one, and then you had the one in to deal with the LRA. In sort of Sudan, South Sudan, and this was obviously deal with George Kony. To deal with the situation there, LRA. And then you have the sort of Accra initiative, which is a semi ASI or ad hoc security initiative, which really hasn't been upscaled to the way it needs to be, you know, partly because of mandates and whatnot. But these alternative initiatives, what they're designed to do is deal with cross border issues. So the idea is, you have a group like Boko Haram who are going across different border ports. And because UN peacekeeping and African led peace support operations are to deal with the whole state only, they don't have the power to go into another state and pursue those terrorists. Yeah. And so these mechanisms are designed to go across border. And so that's what you are seeing emerging, more of these mechanisms, or you might have bilateral agreements where a state, for example, Rwanda, might have a bilateral agreement with Benin or with Mozambique to deploy, oftentimes to push these forces or to push terrorists away from particular areas, or to clear the way for another regional grouping to come in and deal with the situation. And so that's where we are with that aspect in terms of security deployment, which again, if you look at the UN's mandate and its sort of its doctrine, it's not allowed to do that. It's not allowed to cross over two or three states. An African-led peace support operation is not allowed to do that, particularly in the AU context, because it's designed to deal with the state, a state only. And so these ad hoc security initiatives are crossing borders because, one, they're communicating, they're coordinating on the operations. But again, they also have the same challenges that I mentioned before. They're very much security focused. They very much lack the civilian dimensional aspect. There's very much little space for mediation and other stuff. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's not as extensive as one would have hoped, particularly if you look at the efforts that were done in the 80s and 90s, particularly around mediation and whatnot. And so, what, again, going back to that point about the depth of stabilization, we are arguing for a more holistic approach that captures all of these aspects. If you look at the coups that took place in West Africa, what are some of the indicators? Because by all accounts, Mali 5-10 years ago was doing well. Not 5 years, but maybe 10-15 years.
10 years
was on the good road to democracy. That was what people were saying. So what went wrong? So actually, for us, it's not. It's moving away from the current indicators to say, actually, let's look at this thing in more broad aspect, where humanitarians, those in stabilization, those doing mediation, those doing security, everyone comes together to form one form of a political doctrine or political, as it were, mandate to support the state moving forward or support the region or the areas coming forward who are affected. And so that's really what we're seeing now. That phenomenon is something I wouldn't say new. It's new in the sense that it's crossing borders. It's not new in the sense that we've had coalitions of the willing. So if you think of ECOMOG, Liberia, these were all coalitions of the willing that you saw in the 90s. The difference being is they couldn't cross border. They couldn't cross each other's borders. But now they can do that through these ad hoc security initiatives.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I think I can see where you know, when they say African, you know, the term where they say African solutions for African problem, and the way Africa is beginning to take the forefront in terms of solving these issues. But then again, like you rightly pointed out, we tend to see the same problem we see with the UN mission is what we see. So you see, for instance, with Mozambique. So we've got an episode that is going to air next week. So we had someone coming and we talk about where Rwandan forces have been effective to some extent in some areas. The SODOC itself, the region is not looked at in that way. They're seen to have frosty relationship with the civilians that they've come to protect. They've been accused of selling stuff. And then again, there's also interest. So you look at Rwanda, for instance, where Rwanda is part of the group in DRC. And Rwanda is also accused of supporting the M23 rebel groups, and everyone has interest. So we kind of like see the same issue, whether it's an African-led or UN-led issue. They see the Sahel as well. You're seeing with ECOWAS, and ECOWAS not being able to firmly wade in into the coup plotters in Niger, Burkina Faso, and all of that. So I agree with you that we need a much broader, holistic approach to it. But with Russia coming to the picture, coming to this picture, how do you see that moving forward? Does that complicate the whole situation, or does that?
Look, I mean, there have always been mercenaries in Africa. Let's be honest, and this is something that I've spoken about publicly, and many will probably hate me for saying this. Look, there have always been mercenaries from all sides, and let's be very candid and honest. I'm not a pro-Russia person, and I'm not going to stand here and advocate for Africa, Russia here. But I think what I'm not too happy about is the over-focus on Russia, particularly the Wagner group, because I think what it does is it detracts from the issues. It detracts from what is going on, why it's happening, and why those states are looking towards that model. There is a problem. And if a state has to hire a mercenary, it means it's desperate. It means that things have not gone right. And then we need to question why. Why did that operation the French operation that was there for X amount of years didn't work the way it needed to. Mm. Why was it ineffective? Yeah. Yes, there were parts when it was, there were parts where they had challenges. But more broadly, we need to ask these questions instead of saying, well, they're going to Wagner. Because for me, that's an unhealthy conversation. And again, even if you look at it, a lot of it is Wagner in Africa. And that tells you how I would say, for the most part, and I would even probably push and say, very unaware people are of the African continent. There are 55 African countries by the AU standard, 54 if you want to count the other method. Wagner can't be in every country. If there's an estimated 18 to 20,000 of them, and most of them on the border of Ukraine, they can't be in everywhere in Africa. So again, that even that use of the term, and again, I'm not advocating for Russia here. What I'm saying to you is, unless we have these nuanced conversations, then we miss the challenges. We miss why people are looking there. Because again, if there are 18,000 and 15,000 across the Ukrainian border, that means there's only 3,000, maybe 5,000 across Africa. They're not all across every African country. So again, why am I saying this? It's important because if we misrepresent the context, then we've misunderstood the reasons and the thinking behind why states, but also those in power, make decisions like they do. And that is crucial, because if we're going to re-engage, and the way we re-engage, that's important. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect for me is, again, it's really about that broader aspect. Once we figure out and understand why it has gone wrong in the Sahel, why ECOWAS hasn't been as credible. I mean, we recently visited the Gambia, and we're hopefully producing a report and a paper on the Gambia. And we understand why the AU and ECOWAS couldn't intervene in the Gambia. We understood why SETO. These are smaller states. Yeah. It was different in the 90s, where you had an all-out sort of war, different situation. Yeah. These are different contexts. And so with the Gambia, what we have found was actually internally, things are ripe for change. Now, that change wasn't capitalized where we are now, but things internally were ripe for change. The difference for the Gambia was they looked to ECOWAS for that guidance. And then the question then comes to me, why is that Mali, Burkina Faso, and others in Niger are not looking to ECOWAS for that guidance? Because young people wanted that change. But what went wrong? What went wrong with the promise of democracy? Why wasn't it working for those people? And until we understand that, we will never understand the reasons why those coup leaders are there where they are. So again, it's about really trying to understand the local dynamics, the local needs, those challenges and issues that help us to pivot away from the sort of headlines, again, Wagner, Russia, or doomsday, to really understand deep down what went wrong. Because I'm telling you, if you spoke to any of those people on the ground, they'll tell you there were so many other issues. They thought democracy was going to promise them this, and it wasn't working for them. And that's what I mean about really understanding the root causes of these challenges. I mean, it's the stuff we teach in conflict resolution 1.1, but yet still nobody's doing.
Yeah. And that's why there's a book we've just that contributed to that, we've just published, and it's quite, we're looking at local dynamics and global connections, and how, and it was the idea of when we talk about globalization, or what was localization. What was the concept that I was running through that edition? And the point, like you just rightly mentioned, is, you know, in a way, discarding local dynamics, local root causes, and then, you know, just internationalizing those grievances without dealing with them at the root causes. But if we look at again, we look at Africa, the continent is very blessed. Look at DRC, it's got so much resources, like Riley said, that we're not tapping into. You look at the side, look at all of these places, and there seems to just be, it seems to be one that is so much conflict. And then the overt focus on stabilization at the, you know, rather than focusing on what needs to be done. So I guess the question is, what is the, in terms of all of these other alternatives that we're seeing, you know, the African-led, you know, all this new stuff, how do you project looking forward? So what is the future of, how do you see it? Let's say next 10 years, 20 years from now, what is going to be the future of security in the DRC, in the Sahel, in this place, and in terms of the missions as well? What do you say with these new initiatives forward?
Well, I think we will see more versions of this. They will look very different from what we have now. I don't think all of them will be security. And I think the AU and other institutions are going through that learning curve that the UN in particular had in the 80s and early 90s, particularly out of Yugoslavia and Rwanda and all those challenges. Mm. So I think these African-led peace support operations will go through an evolutionary approach, particularly where many of them might try to come under the AU as a regional continental body. Others will adapt more of an adaptive stroke context-specific approach. And we're seeing these adjustments, particularly with missions like the Accra Initiative trying to engage more with people, the Rwandans in Mozambique, Northern Mozambique, again, trying to engage more with local communities. So I think these adjustments are taking place, but it will take time. So I think we will see more of them. But I think what will definitely happen more of, particularly now in the era that we are in now, is one, I think there'll be more of a focus on preventative diplomacy going forward. And what do I mean by preventative diplomacy? More willingness to engage before a crisis emerges, more shuttle diplomacy, more use of special envoys, I think will take place, particularly from the AU side. Because again, the situation is becoming unbearable, partly because you're seeing this fragmentation of the context, but also again, more of these challenges emerging, which become difficult to deal with. So that's, I think, the first thing. The second aspect, as I said, more linked to wider aspects like elections, democracies. Now, there's been conversation about changing APSA and revising it and making it more modern. The reality is, in the context that we are in now, to try and change that, there's no harmonization, no agreement, would be very difficult. So what I suspect will happen is you will see more states or more individual groupings really holding individual states that go off track to those protocols and those agreements and really trying to narrow it and say, actually, no, this is the rules. This is what you signed up to. You are part of this club. You need to hold and respect that. So I think that is the move that we are likely, or should I say, we are more likely to see going forward. The other aspect that I think we will see is more UN-AU partnerships. And I don't mean large peacekeeping operations, but what I mean is more UN engagement in terms of support offices that might be built. You might see more UNDP engagement in terms of more broader aspects. And they've got work on climate, peace and security and in the stabilization context. So I think this type of contractual exchange is likely to take place more, because again, these are models that have been largely successful in places like the Lake Chad Basin, like the LGA, that are working, again, with challenges, but are working in the right direction. So I think this is where we're more likely to see. The key for me here is ensuring that when these things are done, there is strict coordination, strict agreements, and everybody's working together. Because the moment everyone is trying to do everything in their own place, you know, because of what they want and what their captors want, then you end up in a challenge. Because again, everyone is then playing off one and each other. The focus is on trying to outrun your partner as opposed to focus or working in the interest of the state or the people that it's supposed to serve. So I think for me, that is the third dynamic that we are likely to see. A fourth thing I think we might see more localized conflicts, cross-border issues and challenges, because that's something that I think we have largely ignored, but we might see more local peace agreements in that context. And what I mean by that is more localized ceasefires, localized agreements that I think the AU and the UN can capitalize on to create those safe spaces. And I suspect that will be the way forward. How do we enable these local communities, for example, in northwestern part of Nigeria, to be able to hold or come together, form a peace agreement that the UN and the AU and regional bodies support. Now, for me, that enables those actors to hold not just the AU, UN and others accountable, but also to pressure locally those groups that are in conflict to account. And so for me, that would be the model going forward. More localized ceasefires, more localized agreements, which really tap into the local and sort of capacity, but the local really, not just the capacity, but the local skills and abilities that are there. And what I'm trying to sort of say is where you might have a local chief and a youth leader and a woman leader who's in that community serving in an unofficial role, we might see more of these sort of engagements, partly because, again, they are closer to the context, partly because an institution like the AU is too far removed to be able to deal with that. And so for me, that's where I would be pivoting. If I was in sort of this head role, that's why I see it's a trajectory. But again, I see it as where the AU and the UN in its partnership should be supporting.
I agree. You know, in my recent book, one of the, and when I say it to people, I say it in the way it's like, is I said the future of Africa, and I'm glad you mentioned it as well, is like the youth. And you mentioned, I said the youth and the women are the ones that are going to change it. And when I say it that way, you know, it's like, look at from what you've said, that you talk about fintech, you talk about youth innovative approaches that could bring, you talk about using Senegal as a module to say, okay, that, you know, it can actually work. If it's worked in Senegal, then you'd have the hope. And then again, we're looking at Nigeria as well, the last election, see how, you know, a lot of youths came out to for the first time to vote and yeah, really had hope.
I would add to that, I mean, Africa has the capacity. Let's be very honest. If everyone from Africa has the ability to be tapped into the way it should be, and we think away from just government structures, which is oftentimes a problem, and we think more private, allowing individuals to be able to run their own businesses. I mean, you only have to look to Nigeria as an example.
Yeah.
The amount of business, I mean, any Nigerian that you know, and I'm originally from Ghana, as you know, but any Nigerian you know will say, I'm running some sort of business.
Yeah.
That's an entrepreneur spirit that can, again, or you speak to a Somali person who, I mean, everybody has their own ways. And I think what we're not doing is, we're not tapping into that. What we're doing is, okay, government, making this big sort of state, when actually what we should be doing is investing into those people. That woman at the marketplace who, you know, is able to negotiate and get around and be able to say, okay, this person here owes this rent. You know, all of those things are really crucial and important. Why? Because they are the future economies that we need to build. It's not just in the sort of state-run industry stuff. That is one aspect. But the other aspect that I think we so, for whatever reason, and I think it's such a disheartening thing to hear and see, is we just trod on it like it's nothing. When actually, the reality is, for most of us, it was that one woman in the marketplace who was part of the family, who was selling stuff that they enabled us to go to school or enabled the whole community to be able to school. And my grandparents, that example, you know, my grandma would sell things in the market, do things, taking kids here, there, left, right, center, and the whole community knew my grandma. And even, you know, God rest her soul, I didn't see them, but, you know, going to funerals or family events, you'd see this picture of your granddad. But it created that sense of community, that sense of entrepreneur, and everyone is able to contribute and to build the community together. And I think we've lost that. We need to move back to some of that stuff, because why is that important? It's important because that's how we bring people back.
Cohesion, I agree with you, Andrew. And I think, to be honest, the more, and that's why I think it's important that you know, the intellectuals also have a role to play in you know, spotlighting these things and helping to creating a platform for this kind of like engagements to happen. But yeah, I agree with you 100%. We need to look inwards. We need to look, you know, at those micro level approach. There's always, and I think the UN is always is at that macro level, is at that, you know, supra kind of like civilization, which I query, I disagree. Sometimes it's necessary for the short term. You know, like people say, we can't have development without peace, you know, without argument. But in the long term, for sustainable development, it has to be that approach. Andrew, I'm really grateful to have you, you know, join me today for this very insightful conversation. I really enjoyed your beautiful insight into this issue. And, you know, like you started with, a fair assessment, you know, no criticism, fair, you know, your objective, you know, say where the UN has failed, say where it's, you know, it can do things better, where it has succeeded. Well, thank you for coming on today, and I look forward to speaking to you some other time, and we'll keep you posted once this is gonna air, and hopefully you help us share it among your network as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time as well.
All right, Andrew, you have a great day.
You too. Take care now.
Bye. Thank you once again for tuning in to this week's episode. As usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Andrew Chi, for providing a very deep and useful insight into the UN missions in Africa. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.